Welcome to Emotional Sobriety. Alan's back on the pod, returned from New York to tell us about some tennis adventures and hopefully feeling better from his flu. How's it going today, Alan?
Well, I am starting to recover. Boy, it's been quite a week. I had a great time at the Open, and I come back and God, I've been sick, man. I tested for COVID. It wasn't COVID, but man, I had one of those coughs that every time you cough, it feels like putting knives into my chest. I mean, so I'm at day seven now after getting sick, and I'm starting to feel better, but I'm not 100% yet. This is going to be one of those 2 week deals, I can tell right
now.
Did you get
sick after you got back?
Yeah, you know what I think happened? I think it was Saturday night. Saturday night, my son Nick took me to see The Outsiders, a great play. And we walked from the restaurant, no, from my hotel to the restaurant, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And the crowd was so dense, man. Mm-hmm. It was shoulder to shoulder. My hunch is that I picked up something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now this is just me looking on the bright side for you, but it's like I was just thinking, I hate being sick when I'm traveling. So yeah. I'm glad you got back home before you got it. Yeah.
Oh no, it would have been a miserable week sitting there watching.
Oh God, it can take something beautiful and ruin it. Yeah.
And then I realized that day that when I was at the Open, and I was so wiped out. And I actually laid down for about 3 hours. They had heat warnings for all the players. Wow. They had the longer changeovers, a few matches they had to stop. They had to close the roof on the places because the heat was so oppressive that day. And I don't think I fully recovered from that either, man. That heat, when you get started in heat, it just wipes you. So anyway, but then look, the U.S. Open is one of the most exciting tournaments that's ever happened at the Open because so many new faces are in the finals. Yesterday's women's final was phenomenal. Sabalenka and this upcoming U.S. player, Pegula is her name. And she gave Sabalenka everything that she could handle and lost in the end. But it was like 7-5, 7-5, something like it was just a great match to watch.
Cool.
Very exciting. And today's men's final is with two players that have never won the Open. Skinner and an American player, Taylor Fritz. So it's kind of cool.
That's, I don't follow tennis like you do. It's like, but in terms of sports, I've noticed as I get older, as I get to be an old man, storyline matters to me more than anything. Noticed that when I'm watching football, it's okay, I want that young fella to do good, you know, because he deserves it. But to see two young guys in there that haven't been there before, you just put yourself in their place and think, how exciting can that possibly be, man? That is amazing.
Yeah, it's so true. So it's been a very exciting tournament for me to watch.
I can't tell you guys enough to watch the new film Challengers about the tennis match or about like the tennis thruple.
I heard that that's pretty good. I heard that
it's great. Yeah, it's like a tennis star. Yeah, she gets injured, so she can't play. She's a pro. So she basically pits these two childhood friends against each other who are pro tennis players that she has like a romantic entanglement with. Because her thing, what turns her on isn't romance, it's being on the court. And so she can kind of actualize her tennis dreams through these two guys by getting them super jealous and kind of in competition with each other. So it's this amazing kind of like finding like that ecstatic joy through tennis, in a way that, you can in the bedroom or, elsewhere.
Well, by the way, spoken like a true writer. I mean, you're totally coming from the writer's position when you're talking about that. That's great.
Yeah. No, and I think that there may be a fetish in that too, Patrick. I think that she gets off a little.
She does. Oh, she loves it. Yeah. You got to watch it. It's great. But I was so glad when I went to the Open to see you in 2023, I had mono and, that's not a non-contagious, it's not a, through the air kind of transmissible thing. So I determined I could travel with that. I felt like total shit, but I was so glad I suited up and showed up because I met you and your son. And, you know, some trips are like that. You get sick, but like looking back,
yeah, you do it anyway. I've had a few of those myself, but
you play hurt.
You play. Yeah. So one of the things that have come out about tennis lately, or one of the findings that has been that come out, and they had it on, they've now painted it on the court and stuff. It is the healthiest sport for adults to play. That they've done studies now where they've looked at tennis players and other players and stuff like that. And they find that if somebody is actively involved in tennis 2 to 3 times a week, it's probably the best form of exercise somebody can have, because it's not only just a physical thing, it's a mental thing.
Yeah.
So you have to be fully engaged to be playing, right? Which, you know, going to the gym, yeah, it's a bit mental, but lifting weights, there's no strategy to it. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't say, I'm going to come in from a 45 degree angle on the weights this time. Mm-hmm. You know, don't do that.
It's right, just, right.
you pick up the weights. But tennis really forces somebody to be involved up here as much as they are here. And I think because it's that total involvement. And there's a few other sports like that. I'm not saying it's just tennis. It's found to be one of the best sports that adults can play.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, because you and I have had several conversations about the Timothy Galloway book, Inner Tennis, which I read way back in the 70s when I was playing tennis. And what I've always said is without me knowing it, it was the first self-help book I ever read.
Right.
And I still use things from that book. I don't play tennis anymore. But
case in point, isn't it, Tom? I mean, your point is exactly. I mean, you know, he talked about self one and self two, right?
Yeah.
How that is it. And he was talking about the intrapsychic model, as you call it. He was talking about internal family systems, Gestalt therapy.
But he also got, that was my first example of what I call like mantra psychology, because to remedy that stuff, I always talk about the one exercise I remember there was bounce hit. And it's like what he did is gives your conscious mind something to hold on to, that and as long as you're holding on to that, you cannot hold on to anything else, which is what a mantra does. It holds the place. And it's like, and I wasn't a great tennis player ever, but when I did what he said, I always played better. And that was mental. You're exactly right.
Yeah. So true. Well, as my check-in, I'm just going to, I went to Tom's workshop yesterday and there was some talk of perfectionism. And then I went to work. I shot some videos for a law office. And part of, you know, the detail on that was to coax performances out of the two attorneys to make a series of kind of like ads for, you know, their firm. And anyway, where my perfectionist voice came roaring up was one of the attorneys was really struggling. You know, I'd worked with her before. And whereas the other one has a lot of media training and, you know, it just flows like water, she had a lot of anxiety and it was really. And anyway, I just kept sitting there and I'm trying to help her and trying to get the everything in front of the camera to gel. And I just keep thinking like, God, my monosyllabic, like leaden, you know, like directing, you know, to mm-hmm. kind of like help this talent. And I'm thinking about like, oh yeah, I wonder what like Stanley Kubrick or, you know, like all the guys that I revere, all the guys that I revere, you know what I mean? Like how they would be able to like, okay, one sentence, bam. They tell her what she needed to hear. They would be going, and you know, the day would just flow. And I was not able to talk that perfectionist voice down, but I was aware of it. I was aware it was yelling at me, and that I was making a very unfair comparison in my mind between me here now and some other like idealized version of myself.
Well, let's go back to the workshop just for a second, because you're never going to talk that voice down. It's like, you know, it's a mistake we make. You're going to separate yourself from it. You're going to use Alan's language. You're going to differentiate from it. And you're basically going to disagree and disobey with it. You're going to make it more and more irrelevant. It's like, you know, you put him in the corner. The perfectionist can just talk. You stand there and talk all you want, you know, and it's like, you just let them go on and on and on. They wear out after a while. I mean, it's not, we can't make them go away, but they go away when we start ignoring them. But we can't ignore them until we recognize them. And that's what you were doing yesterday.
I was trying. And, you know, as long as I was having that wrestling match with my perfectionist self,
mm-hmm.
that was taking me away from the moment. The moment is where I can actually affect something. And that's the moment where I can actually kind of identify opportunities to kind of communicate what I need to communicate and do the thing I needed to do. And that's the thing, is I'm always painfully aware of like how that kind of like ego match was just completely fucking up my capacity to just be there. You know?
Well, ironically, I think probably the better thing to do is to get back to monosyllabic. You know, it's like the simpler, the better.
Well, listen, one thing to do, Patrick, that I found, like when I teach tennis, because I do that sometimes, you know, with certain players, I usually spend more time on the couch than on the court. But
nice.
But what I do is it's a very interesting thing. I have them, first of all, make the worst. And this, I'm saying it and couching it in the words that you use. Go ahead, and I want you to do a terrible job. Let's record the worst thing you could do. Let's record it. Now try to do a better one. Now let's do another one. Do it real bad again. Now do another one. You don't resist it. Don't resist it. Let them go with it. Just put it on camera. Just say, go ahead, let's the worst thing you could do. Make the biggest fool of yourself as you can.
That's fantastic.
So you don't resist it. See, what happens is people try to resist these things instead of going with it, so that then you get rid of it. See, what Tom is saying is you can't resist it. You can't get rid of that voice. It's not going anywhere. Let it play out. And then there's room for something else. But you see, as long as it's in there trying to take control, there's not room for you to do a lot with that person.
That's such great advice. We've got two more shoots in the next month or so. I'm going to absolutely do that.
This is a great example of what we're doing here with the program too, is that the connection between what we're doing with emotional sobriety and just straight out 12-step program is not the same, but it's all there. I mean, how long have we listened in the program? What we resist persists. All we're doing is looking at that a little closer and seeing how that works. It's like the wisdom is there, man. It's just, we got to figure out how to put, and I think that's one of the things we do in emotional sobriety is we take some of that wisdom and we work on how we actually do it. It's like, because, you know, that's the question. And don't you get this a lot, Alan, as a therapist, where people go like, first of all, people love to say when I suggest something to them, easier said than done, which I get really tired of because I tell them I do. I go like, yeah, all right, we got that part, but it doesn't mean you can't do it. It just means it's hard, you know, and if it wasn't hard, you wouldn't be here getting help for it. You know, give yourself a break. But it's like, then the next thing they'll say, but okay, how do I do it? That's a question we work with. We go, okay, now let's look at that. So sometimes let's look at how we fuck it up so we can learn how we do it. But sometimes it's just really a matter of saying, how can we break this down and make it and not always this easy, but or this simple, but sometimes, well, how can we make this a 1, 2, 3-step process where you actually know what to do to make a difference? And what you're doing is giving an opportunity to do that. Start here. Start by thoroughly inviting the perfectionist in. Come on in. We'll do it your way first.
How you doing, Tom?
Love it. I'm good. I had fun yesterday, and slept in one of my D's shows came back on Slow Horses. I don't know if y'all watch Slow Horses with Gary Oldham. It's back on, and we watched the first episode of that, and I slept in this morning, and life is good.
You know, every time I see a billboard for the Old Man with Jeff Bridges, I think of you because you were telling me that's a good show.
Oh, I love that show. I can't wait till it comes back on. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Lithgow and Bridges is so cool.
I love those guys. So the workshop, it was a success in your view?
Yeah. It's the first time, Dallin, but pretend to be impressed. It's like I'm always doing self-deprecating things about how I don't plan for anything. I mean, and it's, you know, I mean, it's kind of fun to play with that. But the truth is, I'm pretty uncomfortable with the fact that I'm not good at organization. I decided in doing this workshop, this was, you know, I'm getting ready to do it. This was the second time. I'm getting ready to do it again the third time next month. It's like I actually sat down and did what I used to do when I was with Pessy Healthcare. We're doing training, which we always had to create a booklet as an outline for the thing. And it's a mini version of it, but I wrote like a 20-page outline of what I was getting ready to do and actually formatted it, sent it out to everybody ahead of time, and used it. The reason for my insecurity, one of the reasons for my insecurity is I discovered a while back that I assume everybody knows what I know. People were fired up at the end of that thing. They were fired up because of the content.
We grow through our work if we pay attention.
Oh, God, yes.
A sponsor gets as much out of the sponsoring as the sponsee. I mean, it's true with therapy, too. I mean, we grow as a therapist, as a trainer, as a teacher all the time as we pay attention to this stuff. Right. I can see.
Right. We can just give lip service to the fact that we say it's collaboration. But you're right, Alan. You and I know it is collaboration. It's like, no, we're, and if we're not learning something, you know, it's sort of like the beginner's mind with Buddhism. It's like, I read a quotation from Ram Dass this morning that says, when you think you know, your mind has calcified again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I love the idea of, I mean, in that way, even our insecurity, I can overdo it, but it's like, even our insecurity is part of our humility. And it's not a bad thing.
And you know what that means to me, what Ram Dass, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what Ram Dass is saying is that it's okay to know, but hold it in your hand lightly. As though it's the only reality. It's right. Like, hold on to it. You know, it's like, it's funny that there's so many analogies to tennis now. You know, if somebody's starting out tennis, they want to grip that racket as hard as they can. And the truth is, you've got to hold that racket just to the point where it's not falling out of your hand.
Mm.
I mean, you've got to keep such a loose grip on it. And it's the same thing when you know something, keep a loose grip on it.
I love that.
So you can let it go when you need to let it go. When you realize, because you know, Tom.
And it's not the only thing that what you said.
We found a truth. This is it.
Right.
This
it's not the only truth. It's not the only truth. It's like.
Not the only truth. Grip it, grip it, hold on to it very loosely. And all this, that'll be the theme for this podcast today. We want to talk about is that when you know, you're experiencing something in life, and even if you think you've really found an answer, great, enjoy it. But hold it lightly in your hands. Hold it loosely in your hands so that there's always room for a new experience. See, and that's what a big part of, you know, we talk about freedom. Well, what is freedom?
Right.
Freedom is having the possibility of a new experience at each and every moment of our life. That's what freedom is. If we want to define it in that way, and I don't know if we've ever defined it that way before,
mm-hmm.
But freedom is, you know, having the possibility of a new experience at any given moment of your life. Well, my God, you know what Ram Dass said, if you're holding on to an idea and this is it, you've got it, and this is, there's no room, there's no freedom in that. You're now fixed, you know, you become fixed at that particular point in time.
Right.
Now, we'll also say what we said earlier. Sometimes you've got to own being fixed before you can be unfixed. See, it's not that we're not going to, where you feel bad about being fixed. If you're fixed, just own it. That's okay. That's how you start to hold it lightly. I'm right.
Well, otherwise, yeah, false humility is not humility.
That's right. Yeah, say that again. Everybody's got to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, false humility is not humility. It's like it really. Yeah, one of the things I say to people is when you are competent at something, regardless of whatever level of competence you have. And I don't know if this is the truth or not. This is something I like to believe, that if to the degree that I'm competent, and that's part of what I'm talking about with what I learned yesterday, is I have not only a right to confidence, I have a responsibility to confidence. I have a responsibility to, like you, and what you, your words, Alan, own it. It's like if I know how to do something and I know that I'm this good at, or I'm pretty good at whatever, say that. I mean, I don't say it to everybody out all the time out loud, but I need to be sure I'm saying that to myself, that basically I don't need to sit there and manufacture, you know, insecurity in the name of humility.
With freedom comes spontaneity.
Yes.
See, without freedom, there is no spontaneity. So we cannot respond spontaneously to a situation. Our response will be more fixed. And see, that's the whole thing here, this whole idea of emotional sobriety. As I read it and started to understand it from Bill, and it's still, look, even this, we're talking about this. We've never talked about this element of emotional sobriety.
Yeah.
We're even discovering new things, you know, as we go along. Yeah. Like we did last Thursday night. I mean, it was great having you guys sit and kind of review everything. Mm-hmm. Funny how Art comes in and then does this. He's going to go ahead and do a master class on it. I mean,
Oh,
you just aced it. Get out of here.
I'm
doing a lot of reading on Rollo May right now. I'm finding him very fascinating for a lot of reasons. I mean, the therapist that I was in therapy with in graduate school. Mm-hmm. Trained by somebody that was trained by Rollo May, and James Bugendahl has an incredible reputation as one of the best therapists around. I mean, brilliant man. And he was trained by Rollo May, and as I'm reading Rollo May's work, one of the most powerful experiences he had is when he had tuberculosis and he was put in a TB asylum where they had all these other patients that were laying around with tuberculosis, some of which were going to live and some which were going to die. He said, that year taught him more about anxiety than all of his training in his career.
Wow. Yeah.
Because he's laying there with all of these people confronting life and death on a daily basis, and how they were dealing with it, what it was meaning to them. I mean, it was a powerful thing. And you could see the change in his writing from that point on.
Oh, that's cool.
It was a major, major shift in his thinking and his experience, because once again, he had all this great knowledge, brilliant man, but he was holding it loosely.
Yeah.
So that there was room for new information to come in. And listen, that's the key. And look, every clinical mistake I've made is because I was too rigid. There's no question about it. I can look back at that every mistake I made is because I thought I knew what I was. I thought I had the answer and that there was no for someone else.
Oh, and let me co-sign that. Every mistake I've made in a non-clinical sense has been because I've been too rigid. I think that there's something to be said for that.
Personally, too. And I think that that's part of what we're seeing. And look, how does this fit into the expectations? Expectations make me rigid.
Mm-hmm.
See, it's a fixed position. You see what I mean? We're already coming into a situation deciding how it has to be for us to be okay. So this really, really is, I think what we're talking about today is a very important concept that we need to continue to explore and work with.
Me too. I'm 70 years old. I have visited this very topic that I'm talking to you guys about multiple times in my life. I have had successes. I can tell stories from way back how I learned some things about this and then forgot them again. But right now, I'm as much a veteran in my career as I'm going to be, and I'm still dealing with things. And it's not a bad thing. It's just a thing. It's just the way we do it. We're being in the present moment, maybe the nutshell is if we're being in the present moment, we'll probably be busy.
It's nice to lead with substance instead of charisma, because when you lead with substance, the charisma tends to flow more naturally, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
When I'm convinced that things have to be this way to be okay.
Yep.
See, that's the danger zone.
When we think we know how it needs to be. But most of the time, when I'm acting out of that assumption, I just am assuming there is a way it's supposed to be. I don't even know what it is. I just assume there is a way. You know, there's an answer in the back of the book, you know, and we got to let go of that. There's not. Life is an essay test, man. It's not multiple choice or short answer.
What makes us hold on to something so tenaciously, right? So in such a firm, keeping such a firm grip on something.
Yeah.
There's a part of us that is convinced that if it's not this way, something catastrophic is going to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and so it becomes like, this is the life preserver. If I don't have this one and I let go of it, I'm in really deep trouble. I mean, I don't know how to swim. I've got this life preserver. I'm not going to let go of it no matter what you try to do. I mean, you know, Tom, you and I have seen this as how many times? You too, Patrick, in terms of helping someone let go of their addiction. I mean, even though the alcoholism or other drug addiction maybe ruining their life, there's a part of them that feels like if I let this go, there's not going to be anything left of me. I'll be nothing.
Man, that's how I felt when I first stopped drinking. Absolutely. I know it.
That, man. See, and so this idea that these things that we really believe that must be a certain way have deep roots to them. And that's why it's not just a matter of mentally saying, all right, I'm going to let go of that, is to own first this thing that I want it to be this way, because if it's not, you know, I'm in trouble. I'm nothing. I'm no thing. I don't have anything else inside of me. And we convince ourselves of these lies.
Well, and that's the place where it goes back to the workshop Patrick and I are doing yesterday. Is the my little nutshell I use is you move towards your demons because they take their power from your retreat. You go toward that. It's like that, and you teach that probably better than anybody I've ever seen. That basically you just go. You were doing an example of it with Patrick a minute ago. Like, okay, that's what wants to come in. Let it in. It's like, it's very counterintuitive, but it's free. Use another word you're using today. It's very freeing.
Yeah. 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 So this is, all of this is really very much connected to, right? The more freedom I have, the more spontaneity I can have, mm-hmm. the more spontaneous I can be, the better I can respond to any situation according to that situation. And not come in and now put an old idea on that situation in terms of how to cope with it that I probably tried many times and doesn't work. Right? Yep. See, that's the other part of this, is that the old ideas in the, when we talk about in 12 in the rooms, they're talking about fixed ideas. That's all. That's what it means. It's a fixed idea. Any old idea is a fixed point that we've had in our life. And Bill was right. Emotional sobriety is true independence of spirit. But if you're going to have true independence of spirit, it means you have freedom. It means that you can be spontaneous. It means that you're holding these things loosely in your hand, like you said, Tom. And that, and this is what makes recovery and emotional sobriety so exciting. It means that you're open to discovering something new each and every moment of your life.
Well, and this to me, this program, the three of us and Joe and Carol and other people who, and Roger, other people who've come on the show with us, is we're examples of that, in the sense that how else could you explain that we can be doing this for so long and be this old and still be so excited about it?
Yeah, I wanted to say, you know,
that's the coolest thing.
Yeah, in these workshops and, you know, on Thursday night, some of the youngest old people I think I've ever met, you know, because of that inquisitiveness.
Yeah.
So just, I'm not that young.
Other than the fact that our bodies hurt for no good reason, we don't feel old.
Well, let's
there's
just
a reason.
Let's just take today's podcast for an example. We started out, we had an idea about where this podcast was going to go. We were going to go into the Grapevine article. What was the title of it, Patrick?
Sanity.
The title of it was, just so we've got it, A Question of Sanity.
Yeah, so we were going to, that's where we were headed. And then you came in, Tom, and you shared what your experience was with the workshop, and then came Ram Dass's quote. And then all of a sudden, because we weren't fixed, we were able to flow with the subject. We were able to follow that and bring it into emotional sobriety and really start to kind of, you know, sift through it, right? And say, oh, my God, what does this mean? What does this mean for our emotional sobriety? And today, at least I'm sitting here feeling like, oh, my God, we discovered a new way of talking about it. Kind of
and,
cool.
And by the way, it is about sanity. So we kind of stuck on our theme.
It always is weird how it happens like that. That's where you know, one of the things that, you know, I keep learning. I don't have to control it. It will be what it will be. And whatever it is going to be great. It's going to be better than what it would have been if we controlled it.
I love that. Yep.
Until next time, everyone.
Tend your life. Tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.